Voices Radio Network.
The views and opinions of Muscle Minds is for informational and educational purposes only.
Better, stronger, faster. A man barely alive, faster. Better, stronger, faster. Steve Austin, faster. Be that man.
Better than he was before.
Back to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally, and today we have with us special guest researcher Alex Cagliari Turner. Alex, we've had you on before on drugs and stuff with Dave Crossland. I still remember that episode. Dave was like driving around a parking lot trying to talk to us on his cell phone. He like had some weird work situation come up, and he couldn't be in the studio, and he was like, "Hey, I want to get Alex on." I didn't know anything about you at the time. So I was like, okay, you take the lead on this one. And then I had to take the lead. So I'm really glad that we could have you back and have you in a little bit more of an organized fashion now. Guys, what's up? Dr. Scott, how you been?
Good. I'm actually, if I seem distracted, it's because I am. I'm frantically trying to purchase a newly published article that is pertinent to our discussion today. So I'm going through the rigmaroles of getting this bought and downloading it.
Hey, but, what is it? How much does a study cost? What does that run for?
This was a cheap one. It's only $25. Sometimes they're up at $49, I think is the highest I remember seeing, but yeah, $39, $30.
Okay.
I mean, that's if they're not open access, of course, a lot of them free, but it's funny. You will see, I do sometimes see review articles on sites, and almost every article that you see in the review article is a freebie. And which tells me, you know, like so there's somewhat of a bias there just based on money in terms of the evidence that is being selected to support their thoughts. But I probably buy a dozen a month, maybe.
Really? Really?
Like
Wow.
I just got to do it. It's part of, has to be done. Literally. I mean, in my mind,
it's part of being Scott Stevenson, researching stuff, learning stuff. And not just looking at the abstracts, huh?
Yeah. I mean, there's just too much. I mean, I wish it weren't that way. You can snag these for free, but the journals put in a lot of time and money. It's, you know, it's expensive to do all this. So I don't love the system. Trust me. I wish all the information were free. And, you know, there was just like fairy dust that you could just kind of sprinkle onto the computer and, you know, make these things, you know, free for everybody, but it just doesn't work that way. So
right,
I don't mind. Yeah.
Well, can you guys give me a clue here? What are we talking about today? What are our topics here?
Well, Alex, let's talk about your study a little bit, maybe, and then we can dig into some of this information. This is like a playground for me. I really love this topic.
Cool.
Back to the study thereafter, but like, plug your study for us, if you would.
Yes, so I am a second year PhD student at the University of Brighton, which is in southern England, and my research is investigating if muscle exhibits a memory of anabolic steroid exposure. And we are currently still looking for and recruiting participants, men who are aged 20 to 40 years old, who are current anabolic steroid users. And also men who are past anabolic steroid users who finished the cycle 2 or more years ago. And if someone is a current anabolic steroid user, when they come to the lab, if they soon after that visit decide to cycle off and they conduct a PCT and they don't cruise on replacement levels of testosterone, we will then invite them back for further sampling 6 months later. So we can then see how much muscle mass they have maintained after a steroid cycle. And at the molecular level, because we are taking muscle biopsies, we can investigate, does their muscle exhibit a memory of the steroid exposure? However, even if someone is just using anabolic steroids and they don't plan on cycling off, maybe they're in the middle of a blast towards the end, or they prefer to blast and cruise, we can still have them come for a single visit, because once we have collected that muscle piece, we will get a better understanding of the pathways that are activated when steroids bind to the androgen receptor inside the muscle and cause enhanced rates of protein synthesis, which is obviously what causes muscle growth. So we're going to get a better understanding if people do decide to cycle off and return for a second visit, the memory effect. But if people are just, that's not in their plans, but they still are interested in furthering our knowledge on how steroids cause muscle growth at the molecular level with some new technologies that have yet to be applied to humans, then that's what we'll be doing with our research.
So what are the main, if you sort of had to do an umbrella outline, the main mechanisms of muscle memory? Like, this used to be like total bro science bullshit back in the day. And of course, the bros knew that there was something to it. And now it's like, it's literally the gene jockeys are looking into this. It's a sort of a fundamental. It makes total sense, really, like that any tissue that had been previously exposed to something would have a memory thereof, you know, that would allow it to adapt to that new another exposure down the line. That's just, that's sort of basic Darwinian and the basic Darwinian notion there. But what are the big muscle memory mechanisms?
So the fundamental concept here is when a muscle grows in size, what muscle protein synthesis is outweighing muscle protein breakdown, and the nuclei that are inside the muscle fiber, the myonuclei, they are responsible for making those proteins that cause growth. Eventually, the fiber will grow to a certain size where if it is to get any bigger, the number of nuclei inside that fiber have to increase. And the way that happens is inside the muscle, there are stem cells called satellite cells, and they get activated by either standard resistance training or also anabolic steroids can activate them. And they can cause the nucleus of that cell to get donated into the muscle fiber. And that increases the number of nuclei inside the fiber. Those nuclei are then responsible for making more proteins, and the fiber grows in size. And now in 2010, there was a research study that was conducted in mice where they caused the muscle fibers to grow by a technique called synergist ablation. And what they did is inject a dye into the muscle fiber, and they counted the number of nuclei. And what they then did is they cut the nervous supply to the muscle so it couldn't contract anymore. And they also, they did a variety of techniques. They cut the nervous supply physically with scissors. They also injected a blocker that blocked the nervous supply to the muscle. And they also elevated the legs of the mice in the air so that they couldn't walk around. Mm-hmm. And in all of these instances, they're forcing the muscles to not contract. So they're going to cause muscle atrophy. The muscles are going to shrink. They're not contracting. They're not doing anything. And what happened was, as these muscle fibers shrank because of these three different conditions, the number of nuclei did not go down. They were maintained. And so the concept there is that the nuclei that have accumulated from resistance training do not decrease even when the muscle gets smaller. So even when the muscle actually is a cylinder, shrinks down in size, that's just because protein breakdown is outweighing protein synthesis. The nuclei that were accumulated from previous training are retained. And then if you were to then expose that muscle to training, it would be able to grow at a quicker rate the second time around. And that same research group in 2013 realized, well, anabolic steroids cause muscle growth via nuclei accumulation inside the muscle, as well as stimulating protein synthesis inside the muscle. And so they subjected two groups of mice to different injections. Well, they actually used a pellet. They cut the neck of the mice and they inserted a pellet. And one group of mice was given testosterone propionate for 2 weeks, and the other group was given a placebo for 2 weeks. And obviously, at the end of this two-week period, as expected, the muscle fibers grew in size in the mice that were exposed to testosterone, and their fibers got bigger, and their nuclei increased in size. But what the researchers then did was they took the pellet out of both sets of mice, and they left them in their cages for 3 months, and they did absolutely nothing. And bear in mind, 3 months in a mice's lifespan is actually 12% of its life. And at the end of that three-month period, the mice that were exposed to testosterone had lost muscle mass, and they'd actually shrank down to the exact same size as the control group. So they'd lost their gains from the testosterone. But the key difference was their nuclei numbers were still elevated by 28%. Compared to the control group that had never been exposed to anabolic steroids. And then the researchers, for a two-week period, exposed those mice to a form of training. In this instance, it was synergistic ablation, which is where they'll actually cut one of the muscles off the mice's leg, and it will force it to walk around on only one muscle around when it's walking around every day in its cage. And it's a form of continuous exposure to resistance, basically, because its body weight is then causing the muscles to grow. And Alex, the reason why I mentioned that specifically is because that could be a flaw in this study. But still, the researchers decided that that's one of the most common ways they cause muscles to grow in mice is synergistic ablation. So they cut the muscle off. The mice was forced to walk around on the other muscle. And obviously, it's exposed to this. The weight is bearing the weight of the mice. And they monitored the mice for 2 weeks. And this is where it gets really interesting, because remember, the nuclei numbers were 28% higher in the group that was previously exposed to steroids, but their muscle fibers were exactly the same size. After 6 days, the muscle fibers grew by 30% in the mice that were previously exposed to anabolic steroids, and they only grew by 6% in the lifelong natural mice. And at the end of this 2 week period, the muscle fibers of the mice that were previously exposed to anabolic steroids were actually 20% larger than the lifelong natural mice. And so the conclusion of this paper was the nuclei that accumulate from anabolic steroids are retained in muscle through time, and they may actually enable an enhanced rate of muscle growth in the future. So the big question is, all of these studies are done in mice, and now we've built up this lovely theoretical mechanism of muscle memory that in both normal resistance training and in anabolic steroid usage, nuclei numbers increase, they are maintained, even during periods of detraining and muscle loss, but then during periods of retraining, the nuclei then enable muscle growth to happen much quicker because they don't disappear. They're already there inside the muscle. You just have to stimulate the muscle and they'll start making more proteins again and the muscle will grow. So this is now the theoretical mechanism of muscle memory, of how you can lose muscle and then regrow muscle much quicker on a second occasion than you ever can in the first place. And this lab out of Oslo, Christian Gunderson is the head researcher there, has been the group that's mainly been responsible for this. But one criticism of their research has been they have always used synergistic ablation to cause muscle growth. So they've always done this very extreme technique of cutting one of the mice's muscles off, so it's forced to walk around 24/7 on another muscle and bear its whole body weight on that muscle, causing growth. And other groups have decided that we need to investigate this mechanism of muscle memory because it's got implications for public health. Because if you accumulate nuclei inside your muscles when you're in your early 20s and 30s from resistance training, then that means they might be there for your whole life when you become old, you become slightly more frail, and you might be able to retain your muscle mass into your older years from the nuclei you accumulated when you were younger. And that could be one way to try and prevent people from losing muscle mass as they get older, which is that sarcopenia is the research term to describe that, is a problem in society at the moment. Muscle wasting as people get older is a problem. People become frail, they fall over, they fracture their hip, they become a burden on the health service. Whereas if you could maintain your muscle mass as you get older, that'd be good. The second implication is if someone is using anabolic steroids in drug-tested sport and they're caught and they've broken the rules because that's the rules of the federation they're in, the nuclei they might have accumulated from their steroid usage might always give them a permanent advantage into the future. And so that might mean the ban length, which is currently 4 years in the Olympics and other drug-tested sports, might be extended. And also it leaves a question as to if someone has taken anabolic steroids, should they be allowed to compete against people that have never taken them before? So even if they've stopped taking them years ago, do the nuclei that they have from those anabolic steroids, are they maintained that they could always give them an advantage? Right. So
let me interject really a couple to, things here. Oh, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No. You can interject here because then we have to discuss if those findings in the mice are potentially applicable to humans or not, which is the big question.
Well, which is one thing as far as sarcopenia and functional ability during age and what happens as people get older is there's also precedent in the bone mineral density literature there that people who have the highest bone mineral density, the peak around the age of 30, is predictive of where it is later in life when people are more likely to have fractures, hip fractures, those sorts of things. So the idea would be to get as much bone mineral density by doing the right kinds of activities to bring that about, as well as muscle mass. So So it makes sense. It's not like this is sort of a one-of-a-kind type of phenomenon where we're trying to do something in youth that would carry over to later in life. What we do early on in our life does indeed predict our capabilities later in life. So, and yeah, it's the idea of whether natural versus clean is equivalent in some way. If you wait 7 years, like some of the bodybuilding organizations, you know, is 7 years, yeah. Are you once you're no longer natural, does being clean, does that, can it ever be the same as natural? It may not be the case. So
yeah, yes. I will mention there that our research is looking to recruit people who stopped taking anabolic steroids 2 or more years ago. And there's only ever been one other research study published that hasn't been published. It's someone's PhD thesis. They has had some data published, but not this aspect. But he his name is Anders Ericsson. His PhD thesis was published in 2006, and he recruited powerlifters and then looked at the nuclei numbers inside their trapezius muscle and also their leg muscle. And he found that the myonuclei numbers inside their trapezius muscle were still very, very high in guys that had stopped taking anabolic steroids on average 8 years ago. Hmm. And he also investigated the proteins inside the muscle. So what proteins are making up to the muscle? And they used a technology called 2D proteomics, which is just a fancy way of investigating the proteins inside the muscle. And they saw they managed to count the number of proteins, and there were 2,300 of them. And in some of those, one of the guys had actually stopped taking steroids 10 years ago, but in those past users, on average, they'd stopped 8 years ago. 80 proteins inside their muscle fibers were still different compared to guys that had never taken anabolic steroids before. And so that would lead us to believe that because the steroids are binding to the androgen receptor is binding to DNA inside the muscle cell, causing these transcripts to be made that get turned into proteins. If the proteins are different inside the muscle of someone that used to take anabolic steroids, then something to do with that androgen receptor binding pathway is being remembered many, many years after someone has stopped taking steroids. So maybe the regions of the DNA that the androgen receptor has bound to when someone's using super physiological levels of testosterone are being maintained as being open. Maybe there's an epigenetic memory, as you could describe, of steroid binding. And that might be why those proteins 10 years after usage are still being differentially expressed. And that leads us to believe that maybe if you have taken steroids, maybe where is the number of years where you could say that person has no longer retaining a difference or an advantage inside their muscle? We don't know what that number is.
If we look at those particular proteins and what they're, some of them may even not have known functions, I wouldn't imagine. But if you look at those, can we paint a picture that, you know, these proteins are involved with pathways generally that are, you know, creating protein synthesis or encouraging protein synthesis or disencouraging protein breakdown? Like, where do they fit in? Or is it just sort of like, we don't know what they do, but there's definitely a difference?
So that's what exactly I was thinking when I read it, but they haven't done that yet. I don't know if they are going to do that. Yeah, that's the problem, is that study has only said these proteins are different and they haven't gone down to identify them or anything along those lines. Whereas now with the technology we are using, because we're doing RNA sequencing, we're going to be able to get that information. Whereas that technology was probably not available to those researchers at the time, because this study I'm mentioning was the piece of research that was published. It was the same cohort of people, was published in the year 2000, that showed that the androgen receptor content is higher in the trapezius muscle compared to the...
I think we lost Aerox for a second here.
Yeah, we lost you there for... maybe you can hear us, but you're frozen.
Just when someone is taking anabolic steroids.
Oh, we missed about 20 seconds there.
So I was saying the cohort that showed the muscle proteins were different more than 10 years after someone had taken anabolic steroids was the same research that was published that showed that the percentage of nuclei that express the androgen receptor is much higher in the trapezius muscle than in the leg muscle. Hmm. That's from the same cohort of people. And that's why in our research, we've decided that we are taking muscle biopsies of the trapezius muscle because that muscle has been shown to have more androgen receptors and also been shown to retain high numbers of nuclei many years after usage has stopped in the study on the powerlifters I mentioned. So if you want to look at a muscle that might have a memory of steroid exposure, it would make sense we look at that one for the time being anyway. I got sidetracked slightly, but the point of where we're saying about this nuclei accumulation and retention, this has now become kind of like a model that we can work with to see if we can actually see, is this true? Do the nuclei that accumulate from resistance training or anabolic steroids, are they retained? So our study will be the first study that in humans that has attempted to investigate, do the nuclei that accumulate from anabolic steroids, are they retained in the short term? So we are trying to get guys who will finish a steroid cycle close to when they come to us to have a muscle biopsy. And then we invite them back 6 months later, where we measure their muscle mass, take another muscle biopsy and see to have the nuclei numbers gone down. And at the same time, again, further investigate this finding, are my nuclei numbers still elevated inside the trapezius muscle of people who took steroids years ago? But the interesting bit is that even if someone is not cycling off anabolic steroids, if they come to us and we conduct a muscle biopsy, the unique aspect of this project is that we will not just count my nuclei numbers, but we're also storing the muscle inside a genetic preservant that has the ability to preserve DNA, RNA, and protein. And the reason why that's interesting is because the androgen receptor binds to the DNA inside the muscle cell, causes transcripts to be made that are made of RNA that then get converted into protein. And protein is what's caused the enlargement of muscle protein, right? It's what causes the muscles to grow. And we are going to be able to, for the first time in people that have exposed themselves to above normal levels of steroid usage, look at these RNA transcripts. And that's not been done before. And that will give us a better understanding of what regions of the DNA are being activated from anabolic steroids and how much are they being activated? What is their level of expression that they are causing? And, you know, steroids, they interact with the androgen receptor differently. They have different binding affinities. Maybe there could be a difference depending on what someone cycles on. And also at the same time, if someone that comes off anabolic steroids, you get an actual molecular view of the pathways of growth. How upregulated are they when they're on steroids compared to when they're not? And how upregulated are they when someone finished years ago? And so even if someone is just taking steroids and they don't plan on coming off, if they come to our lab, they'll better our understanding on how they cause muscle growth just by us looking at the expression of RNA and genes inside their muscle. So that's another unique aspect.
So for the listeners, I've talked about some of these things. I've talked about the synergistic ablation. I called it compensatory hypertrophy on the show before. This whole second domain, the idea that superphysiological testosterone or AAS use, which is basically superphysiological to a certain degree, extraordinary, pharmacologically speaking, would turn on these genes in a way that persists in some way. And that's an epigenetic phenomenon we're kind of looking at. So are you going to look at some of the genes that are involved with epigenesis, basically to doing all that. There's also microRNAs that seem to differentiate responders from non-responders. And then there's the whole androgen receptor gene itself. And I think the glutamine sequence, there's another sequence in there, which the repeats of the glutamine sequence will change the shape of the androgen receptor and thus its affinity for androgen. It's been studied in the context of prostate cancer. Seems to be racial differences there as well. Is that something you're gonna take a look at? Because then you're gonna do a DNA analysis as well.
Yes. Yeah. So we have the priority of the study is to look at gene expression, right. And that will be the first thing we do is we'll extract the RNA transcripts to investigate gene expression inside the muscle, and we will be using RNA sequencing to do that, which is enable us to look at every single transcript inside there, and then we'll be able to see what genes are being expressed and what's their level of expression, highly expressed or lowly expressed in the different groups, so people who are not taking steroids and people who are. If we get enough RNA yield from the muscle, because the preservative also preserves DNA, then the next step will be to look at the DNA inside the muscle fibers. And because the androgen receptor binds directly to the DNA, we will be able to see what regions of the DNA are opened and with their epigenetic markers, and how that changes through time and also just between the different groups. And there's not been a study yet at all that has looked at epigenetics inside the muscle of an anabolic steroid user. So this would be the first time that will ever be published. And yeah. There's also not been a study, as far as I know, that's looked at gene expression inside human anabolic steroid users exposed to super physiological dosages. There's been gene expression studies in TRT replacement and also growth hormone replacement, but no super physiological studies. So this will be the first time. So we will enhance our knowledge of how steroids activate the DNA inside the muscle to cause proteins to be made. Now the technology is becoming more affordable to researchers, whereas in the past 15, 20 years ago, the human genome had only just been sequenced at the cost of billions. Yeah. Whereas now you can sequence someone's genome in a week for thousands, way less. And the technology now means we can look at gene expression at a much more affordable cost to laboratories. So that's why this research is got these two streams. It's got this gene expression part and also the nuclei accumulation and retention aspect. So I'm obviously very excited for both. And they're both going to enhance our knowledge on AAS and muscle growth.
Hey, what's up, guys? I'm going to jump in here to plug our sponsor, and this will give you an opportunity to kind of like take a break and stand up and stretch your lower back out and really process this first 20-25 minutes of content that Scott and Alex have been going through. It's some deep stuff, and really, they're just getting started. They have a lot more to say, so hang in there, sit down, sit tight. But first, you can continue stretching while I talk about our sponsor, True Nutrition, TrueNutrition.com. Guys, True Nutrition has been around since forever. Basically, since I got into bodybuilding, True Protein was available. They've moved to True Nutrition because they have so much more than just protein products. But they do. They have a ton of protein powders, anything that you could possibly think of, including their pure whey isolate, which is what I recommend to my contest prep athletes, especially as they are closing into the show, because it is a high-quality protein. It digests quickly, and it definitely is easy on the gut. You'll see the difference when you use a high-quality whey isolate like True Nutrition's versus a lot of the cheaper concentrates that are available on the market. So they've got the high-quality proteins that you need, and they've got a ton of flavors, all the flavors that you could possibly want. So definitely check them out for all those things. Plus, I'm sold on their oatmeal flavors now. I've been using the pancake and syrup flavor. I would recommend to get double flavor on that. And then I add my own stevia and a little bit of peanut butter afterward. And it is absolutely delicious. That's my favorite meal of the day, is my eggs and my oatmeal from True Nutrition in the morning. If you want to use the oatmeal, you can get the code ADVICESOATS, which will get you 25% off of those products. If you're ordering anything else, you can use our code ADVICES. That'll get you like the average discount that True Nutrition gives to anybody with a code. It'll help to cover your shipping, and it'll also let them know that you support what we are doing at Advices Radio, as well as at Think Big Bodybuilding Media over at YouTube. Of course, check out Dr. Scott Stevenson's book, Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach. You can go to byobbcoach.com and you can pick up the ebook there, or you can go over to Amazon or Barnes & Noble to purchase the hardcover, which is definitely worth its weight in gold. So guys, check those things out. Now it's time to sit back down, plug back in. Let's get serious. Here's Dr. Scott and Alex.
I have a question that's kind of a technical one, but it would explain something that I've never heard anyone explain, at least give a partial explanation. So if you look at the classical mechanism where a steroid comes in, the androgen receptor dimerizes. So those androgen receptor response elements are upstream from all the genes that would get turned on. But we know that some androgens are more androgenic and some are more anabolic, and that could have something to do with how they bind to and change the shape of the androgen receptor steroid complex. Is there also some variability there in the energy receptor response element in the DNA may be like different base pairs there, such that when the steroid and the androgen receptor come in, if it's more anabolic, it will tend to bind more tightly or for a longer period of time before certain genes that are more responsible for anabolism versus other genes that are more responsible for androgen-like effects, hair growth, and the things that, you know, we typically want to sort of avoid. Is there the androgen response element the same in front of every gene that gets turned on? I just wondered. I don't know, it can be methylated or in some way epigenetically changed differentially, but I don't know what the mechanism would be there. But yeah, I've always kind of wondered how different steroids have different effects. You know, what's going on there? Like, is it a lock and key hypothesis type of thing, or something else work?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so because when the steroids, they have different affinity for the androgen receptor, the cofactors that are then required for that androgen receptor to bind to the DNA, maybe they interact differently, so the intensity of the binding is different. But then you asked about, is the sequence of DNA itself that they're binding to potentially different? That I don't know, but that would make some sense. It would be very interesting to try and work that out. We might be able to, with us, if we can, maybe down the line, if we manage to, because we're going to be able to know the gene expression that's happened from the androgen receptor binding, if we then potentially could, with PCR, amplify androgen receptor DNA inside the muscle and maybe see is the sequence different itself, and then we might be able to see and further answer that question.
Or amplify the response element DNA, you mean?
Yeah. Specifically look at that sequence.
I mean, you would think that you could glean that from, you know, the Human Genome Project, where they, you know, you could say, where are the androgen receptor response elements, and, you know, they, you could see in it all the DNA, the base pairs would be there. And but I don't know. I haven't dug in that deep. I haven't gone quite that far down the rabbit hole.
That's seriously down the rabbit hole. Yeah. That's probably as far down as you can go, but that's that's something that we can consider looking at, definitely, is changes in the androgen response elements inside the muscle DNA. Yeah. And that would be very interesting. I think you can go ahead.
Well, I said the thing that's kind of, it always interests me is you tend to see, this is sort of a bro science, like, you know, out in the trenches type of thing, but Kevin Livroni is someone who people always talk of being a massive responder, you know, and he would just like metamorphosize. And you tend to see people, there's obviously there's some overlap in the mechanisms and the pathways for growing when you're natural versus growing when someone is enhanced. And the whole idea of being a responder versus being a non-responder is really a fascinating one to me. And I wonder, you know, to what extent I've always tried to think of ways. I've actually got in my EndNote database, I've got a whole section about responders and non-responders and trying to figure out ways to kind of hack through the lack of responsiveness in various ways. So we got microRNAs, we've got growth factors, myogenin, IGF-1, those sorts of things. We got satellite cells, we got epigenetic phenomenon. Do you have to simply be training long enough and just pound away for decades in order to get those things to happen? But it'd be interesting to see, like a starting place in my mind would be to look specifically at all those things that have been elucidated as factors involved with responders versus non-responders. Responsiveness. So the things I just ran through in a short list, and see if those are more so expressed in those who are using steroids or have used them, or if those genes are turned on genetically. It seems like there's got to be some overlap. There's not entirely. There are people. I mean, you could have someone who's, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to think if people who have androgen insensitivity syndrome. They generally don't have a whole lot of muscle mass. Like, you will have, if it's a male, genetic male who has that that disorder, so to speak, they simply have the muscle mass of a female. From what I know. So anyway, that was just sort of an aside. It'd be interesting to see if you can sort of like at least come up with a sort of a conclusion that people who respond to gear are also going to be those who respond to the weight training in general. As an aside, he's actually passed on now. There was a guy, he was a kind of a maniac. I'm blanking on his name now. He was a New Zealand bodybuilder who was a great genetics. He was a sprinter for his country in the Olympics. So not necessarily world class, but the best in one of the best in New Zealand. He'd only been doing it for a matter of months. Just so probably a lot of fast twitch muscle fibers, a lot of muscle mass, just genetically blessed. And he hurt his knee. He told me this in private message personally. He hurt his knee and he decided this way, I gotta start weight training to rehab his knee. And he trained for 6 months and he put on 50 pounds.
Wow.
Whoa. And then he heard about steroids and he figured, well, I'm going to do that. That's going to help even more.
Wow.
He was a quite extremist in every way. Like, and he gained another 50 pounds in the next 6 months. Yeah. So 100 pounds in a year. And I've seen pictures of him standing next to Ronnie in his prime and they're basically the same size, not the same shape, but same size. So
damn.
Anyway, yeah. So he gained tremendously just from the training. And plus, like, I mean, he used to tell me about how he'd train. He's the kind of guy who would throw up in the corner and then get back into the squat bar and go again. Like, so he was sort of a loose, little bit of a loose cannon. Very, very nice guy, but a maniac.
Wow.
And an extremist in terms of his drug use, in terms of his food and everything else that he did. But anyway, that's sort of an aside of like one of the best examples of where I think I've seen people that are just, you respond to the weights. Those pathways are very sensitive and easily turned on. From the weights, the steroid. So
yeah, and maybe with someone like Kevin Navarone, where, I mean, epigenetically, the regions that the androgen receptor binding to, maybe they stay more open for him for some reason, and then when he comes back to it, the pathways can just go again, and he can put muscle on quickly. And this is interesting because muscle memory is talked about in terms of nuclei accumulation and retention, but there has been a research study that looked at these epigenetic markers inside the muscle during resistance training, after resistance training, when a detraining period where no one trained, and then a retraining period. And they have shown that when you train with weights, obviously there's regions of the DNA that cause muscle growth get opened up, and then when you stop training, they don't close back fully, they don't go shut all the way, they are actually slightly open still, and then when you go back to training again, they open up at a quicker rate and even more open than they were in the past. And if that's happening just with you lifting weights, there are no steroids involved, but because the steroid is itself DNA binding, you've got to think that there's some way that that's causing regions of the DNA for anabolism to maintain how open they are. That's what you want to investigate. And with us, for the first time, and we're going to try and look into that. That group that has published that research I was talking about, epigenetic memory, Robert Seaborn is the lead author there. I've spoken to Robert before, and I know he's trying to also look into the epigenetic markers inside the muscle of people who used to take anabolic steroids, because he also thinks that there will be different epigenetic markers. So
there's another twist.
Another mechanism of memory. Yes.
Let me ask you this. I'm trying to like nail you with something. But so if you were to isolate DNA in a sample, are you separating the DNA that you would find in satellite cells that are truly satellite cells versus those that are myonuclear?
Yeah, we won't be able to separate them. True, it will just be the nuclei inside the muscle. So that's where it will get different. That's also the same thing they did in that study where they haven't. You can't. I don't think they've come up with a technique where you can actually separate them, because when you have the muscle sample, you have to put a probe in that homogenates the sample and grounds it up to release the DNA out, that you then remove everything else and keep that DNA that you can then look at the markers for. So they I don't think they're aware, I'm not personally aware anyway, of a technique where you could specifically look at DNA markers inside myonuclei proper. It's going to be, there's going to be other cell populations that you're extracting, which is a bit of an issue. But still, at the moment, the best we can do.
I'm looking here at this paper, making sure I'm not going to misspeak, but I just found it. Let's see.
The Seaborn one?
It's a paper where they did that. You know, Berggren et al. I'm not just reading the abstract here. It says, methods, muscle biopsies, vasolitis will obtain from competitive endurance trained athletes, VO2 peak of 64 mL per kilogram per minute. So that's pretty well trained. And their sedentary counterparts and isolated satellite cells allowed to proceed to myotubes. So the cool thing that was there about this is, and this was published in like, it's been a while now, 2005. Damn. So I love, yeah, it's been out for a bit. The interesting thing is they allowed those to culture, and then they found that the cultured myotubes from satellite cells, which had never been in contracting muscle cells, those are just satellite cells that are sitting on the periphery, sort of observing, you know, supervising, gathering information from the metabolic products, perhaps that are wafting past them in the interstitial soup. And when they cultured them, they were more glucose, insulin sensitive. Their glucose disposal rates were higher than those in the sedentary controls. As if they, and that could have been, it could have been just that was the people that became endurance athletes, you know, naturally had that inclination to have better glucose sensitivity, et cetera. And that's why they became such good endurance athletes. But it makes you wonder if the training is maybe like also creating an epigenetic change in the satellite cells that are just there in the periphery. So then there's an interaction. We've got epigenetics in the satellite cells. We've got satellite cells, and we have epigenetics in the nuclei of the skeletal muscle cells themselves.
And
like the confusing picture could be like, if you're just lopping together the myonuclei and the satellite cell nuclei together, you're sampling two populations at once, not knowing that you've got two species of nuclei. And the epigenetic programming could be different. Like in the satellite cells, I would imagine it would be carried forth, but it could be that there's more epigenetic programming that happens once the nuclei have made their way into the muscle cell and become fully functional as nuclei, and then the satellite cells have some epigenetic programming that's put in place. So that's always sort of been fascinating. I'll send you that study.
It's a sequence, because there is a sequence where markers change on the satellite cell progressively until it becomes a myonuclei proper. And you would assume that along that whole differentiation pathway that, markers are going to be changing. So I don't know if we're going to be able to specifically separate them out. We might have to do similar to what Robert Seaborn did, where I don't think they're able to do that. We're still going to learn a lot. But as you say, the next step would then be to differentiate between the two populations. And that you mentioning that is also probably in general where the field is going to go, because although we've painted this lovely picture of nuclei accumulation and retention from muscle growth or steroid usage, a problem like we mentioned, and you've also mentioned, Scott, is that in those Norwegian studies, University of Oslo, they've always used synergistic ablation as the form of hypertrophy in those studies. And now there has been one research study published where they said, and this has come out of the University of Kentucky in America, where they're saying there is a potential problem with using synergist ablation as a form of muscle growth. It's very extreme. It's traumatic to the mice. It is you physically cutting the muscle, one of the muscles off, so that the mice is then bearing its own body weight on another muscle 24/7. And that is unrealistic to normal human resistance training. You'd never be able to do that. It's totally not how muscle happens, but it's a very quick and very effective way of causing a large increase in muscle growth on a time scale that a researcher wants to do for their study, which is why it's used. And this study is great because they actually put mice inside a running wheel, and they use progressive overloads where they added weight to the running wheel every week. And it's quite funny where like they started with 1 gram and then they go to 2 grams and then they go to 3 grams and they progressively are running on the weight, right? It's a progressive overload. It's exactly the way you'd want to train. And the mice, they get bigger. Their muscle fibers increase in size. Their nuclei numbers go up. But they then leave the mice. They don't exercise. They do nothing. They go into a period of detraining. They look into their muscle again. And they were very surprised to see that the nuclei numbers had actually gone down, which goes against this whole model of muscle memory. So in a more physiologically realistic training method in mice, the nuclei numbers had actually decreased. So they had increased from the training. Then when they left them in the cages, they then gone back down to baseline levels, which goes against the whole concept of nuclei being accumulated and then retained from training. And these authors in this research, this is only published in the summer of this year. This is pretty recent stuff. they said this goes to show that we need to do more research to understand why is it in the previous studies where synergistic ablation was used that nuclei that have accumulated are indeed retained and they're not destroyed, whereas in our study, the nuclei that accumulated from treadmill running in a progressive overload fashion went down through time. And this is not a standalone finding now. I know that group there is now further investigating that to try and work out exactly what's going on there. But again, the problem is all of this is in mice. And so what needs to be done is a human study. And in this summer, a human study was published in the Journal of Applied Physiology by this Swedish group. We have to commend them for what they did because it was pretty heroic, where they took 19 people and they trained them for 10 weeks, one leg doing leg extensions. And they did conventional progressive overload training with leg extensions. They did blood flow restriction training as well, where their aim was to increase the number of nuclei inside their quadriceps, was to cause muscle growth and get the nuclei numbers to go up. So train them hard enough that satellite stem cells got activated, causing nuclei donation. Then what they did, they stopped training them after 10 weeks for 20 weeks, where they did no resistance training. And then they decided to train them again for 5 weeks to then see, is the training on the second occasion, did they grow muscle quicker than the first occasion? And is there a memory of their previous muscle growth? Has the nuclei that accumulated from the first training period been retained 20 weeks later? So this study took place over 35 weeks. So it's like three quarters of a year. That's, you know, pretty impressive to be able to do that on 19 people. And unfortunately, the conclusion of their paper was that the majority of people, they didn't train them hard enough that they actually accumulated nuclei in the first 10 weeks of training, which was a big shame because it didn't allow for a rigorous test of this muscle memory mechanism that the nuclei accumulated and then retained through time. But they have published their data for free, available online. And one researcher has dug a little bit deeper into this study. His name is Kevin Murak, and he is involved in the research group in the University of Kentucky, the Center of Muscle Biology. And he has just published a small report. It was published 2 weeks ago now, I think even less than that, actually. And he looked at these nuclei numbers inside these people that were training and lifting weights. On this one leg, doing this leg extensions. And of the 19 people, only 7 of them actually accumulated nuclei. And the nuclei they accumulated, there was a significant difference. And you can see in the graphs a big spike after 10 weeks of training that they have accumulated muscle nuclei. But then 20 weeks later, in those out of those 7 people that did accumulate nuclei, six of them, it went back down and they actually lost the nuclei. And this, again, goes against the whole idea of muscle memory. And this then leads to the question as well, is these mice studies in terms of nuclei accumulation and retention, are they applicable to humans? Because this is one long-term research study that's attempted to be done in humans, although it didn't really train people hard enough. In the 7 people that did accumulate nuclei, 6 of them lost it. So that doesn't really add weight to the muscle memory model. And the mechanism of nuclei accumulation.
Let me throw something out there. So, sorry, you're cutting out so much. I don't want to over talk over
Go for it.
It's a few years ago, and I can send you the article. I wrote it for John Meadows' site, and it's in I think both of my books. I've done a little bit of a comparison of the animal models and the human model of resistance training in terms of muscle growth, and the animal models you get about the same rate and extent of muscle growth when they do resistance training as you do in humans. But you're right that compensatory hypertrophy model is something that produces such rapid and extensive muscle growth, increase in muscle wet weight or what have you, that you just can't ethically do that to humans. Nice. But I have found a study. I don't know, remember how when I happened upon this, I probably jumped for joy and I was doing a Scooby dance in my living room, I'm sure. They do tendon transfers, of course, sometimes with people who have torn tendons or various other issues. And then this particular study, they had examined the cross-sectional area of the leg that had received a tendon transfer in individuals who had torn part of their normal plantar flexors. So in these compensatory hypertrophy studies, they might cut the soleus and see how much the gastroc grows, or cut both the soleus and the gastroc and watch the plantaris, or some combination thereof. And in this human study, the flexor hallucis longus muscle, which normally is sort of a plantar flexor for the big toe, was connected to the calcaneus. So it became an ankle flexor, replacing one of the torn ligaments, and maybe it was a complete Achilles rupture. And there was variability in the extent of muscle growth, but in a couple of, I think the highest number, the highest extent of muscle growth, at least compared to the control leg, so to speak, the other leg, which hadn't been operated on, there was no injury on that side, so there's no reason to do so, was 103% larger in size. And that's in. So that's sort of at least on the same order of magnitude in terms of muscle growth that you see with this compensatory. So that lens, if you sort of look at the whole scheme of things, that I think animals and rats and mice are much more hardy than humans. There's no doubt about that. I haven't done a little work with them. Like, it's just crazy what they can go through. But those, that little bit, it's like, it's just kind of a singular data point, and you're not going to find too many others like that. But it does kind of suggest that there's some possibility that human muscle could undergo those same types of increase in myonuclei if you were to do, you know, expose it to that kind of a stimulus, which you just can't do. I mean, they can hunt down those people and maybe try to biopsy their flexor hallucis longus muscle and see what they get, you know, on both sides. I've never seen a biopsy of that done. Soleus and gastroc are weird enough to do. But so anyway, so there's something out there. But the interesting thing, this sort of makes sense to me. I'm gonna a little praise to my advisor, who's passed on now, Gary Dudley, who was a very like matter of fact, like think basics type of stuff. he published a paper in 1980, which was really, it's one of those ones before I even knew him, I had to have memorized, because he basically took rats, ran them on treadmills at different intensities and for different durations of exercise on a daily basis, and looked at mitochondrial biogenesis. And he found in a very exquisite design that both intensity and duration of training have an impact on the extent of adaptation. So some of the animals ran really fast. They basically did like interval training, and they got tremendous increases in mitochondrial biogenesis. Some of them didn't go quite as hard, but they went longer and they got similar increases. So intensity and duration both impact the extent of adaptation. Just as a basic kind of core physiological notion, I think the same thing probably applies here to some degree if we're thinking about ecological validity and external validity of these studies. Is if we really want to see if there's some sort of an increase in myonuclei, 10 weeks training is not very long. They did train them hard, but we're talking about, you know, what's going on with like Olympic athletes, for instance. We're going to take this idea into, you know, especially with connecting with steroids, those are people who have been training for decades, you know, most of their life. So that's, and of course, it's hard to find, you know, you don't have really a control side or a control person. There's possibility of twins, you know, try to find a twin. There's actually a coach here in the States who has a twin. I don't know if he's bodybuilder before. He was Tadanui, has a identical twin. I don't know anything about him, but I don't know if he trains or not, but you can maybe try to do a twin study and see if there's something going on there. That's another nice model to look at long-term, you know, training. But yeah, 10 weeks, it doesn't totally surprise me necessarily, especially that we know that myonuclei and satellite cells are turned on in response to just injury, as well as what would eventually become a hypertrophic adaptation. So, you know, if you just blast the hell out of them, you know, for a little while, for 10 weeks, it makes sense that would happen. But the other thing that really is, I would love to see someone go into a really deep description of, is like literally when you, it's such an ultra structural organizational, almost miracle to bring in a whole new nucleus and then structure everything around that, including all the contractile material, which is producing these crazy forces. It just, I mean, I just have this almost just perception of the case, like the nucleus is like this little fragile thing, like in its nucleolus, and it's going to just get squished like the yolk of an egg. But obviously it doesn't. So it has to make its way in there and be secured in place so that it can do all of its business in what I think is probably a pretty a large commitment by the cell. So maybe, you know, I don't know if they looked at these markers, maybe there's other markers that we don't know about yet, but maybe some of those seven people of the 19 who showed, I'm not sure how we determined whether it was significant or not, but showed the increase in satellite cell number, maybe they were just in the process of basically setting up shop, so to speak, with those satellite cells where they would become permanent. And it just didn't go long enough. The duration was too short, just like
intensity and duration.
Yeah. You got trained hard enough and long enough. One of the two, has to be there. So that's kind of my thought about it.
That is basically the takeaway is we now have two studies that have showed nuclei numbers go down. But the question is, there is a timeline of a satellite cell becoming a myonuclei, and maybe these myonuclei, they just needed to stay there a little bit longer to gain permanency and protection from decreases in muscle size, because those nuclei that have disappeared, they have to have been destroyed. Like apoptosis must have happened. Something has degraded that nucleus. There might be a certain time point where that nucleus, it develops markers on its surface where it is now protected from apoptosis and being degraded. And that is then evolutionary going to benefit the organism, because if that is protected from degradation, then if you go for a period of famine, your muscle mass is reduced. Your nuclei that have accumulated from previous exposure are retained. And when you come back to training, your muscle growth is much quicker. And so maybe you're right. There is a time course. And I think now, and this is what I know, this lab in University of Kentucky, Kevin Murak and the other researchers are now, especially because their study with the mice running on the treadmill showed nuclei decrease through time. They're going to want to understand, well, maybe there is a time course of the nucleus going into the muscle fiber and becoming a myonucleus proper. And there must be a transition where at some point it gets coated in some sort of protein that's protecting it from being degraded. And it might be, as you say, a matter of intensity of training or the matter of duration of how long it has to be inside the muscle fiber until it gains this full protection. And that's when we'll truly understand the muscle memory mechanism, because it's all well and good understanding that nuclei numbers go up, they're retained and they don't go down, but what keeps their permanency, what enables them to not be degraded through time. And if that's discovered, that could make that's going to be a big deal, because it's going to better. Action. Yeah. That someone's going to try and make a drug out of that. That's going to somehow enable your nuclei to be more permanent, and that could help prevent muscle wasting as a disease.
Yeah.
So that's where the money's going to be coming for that. Because if you could understand the whole pathway of a satellite cell becoming a true protected from degradation myonucleus, our understanding of muscle growth and muscle retention is going to just massively increase. And I think they're on the verge now of designing studies where they may well be, like you suggested, Scott, there might be a level of time that has to be required until this nucleus is protected. And maybe they will train mice and then they will leave them and they'll train them for maybe different periods of time. And maybe some of them will be trained for, say, 4 to 6 weeks, some of them even longer, some of them even longer. And then maybe they'll then be detrained. And a certain number of time after detraining, you'll look into the muscle and see how many weeks have I had to wait until the nuclei have gone down, or have they not gone down? And maybe it might be that the mice have got to be trained for a certain period of time. And then when you go back into look into their muscle after detraining, the nuclei don't go down. Whereas before that period of time, they do. And once you've got that kind of time course worked out, then you could then do what you were suggesting before and separate out satellite cell and myonuclei, look at the cellular markers on their surface, and then see how do they progress and change through time. Because at some point there's going to be a molecular switch where that myonuclei is protected from being degraded. And someone's going to be very famous when they discover that, because that's going to be a big deal.
In Murak's study, they said they're running on a treadmill? Or
yes. I don't think he's the lead researcher, but he's involved in it.
Right.
There was the other guy... I'd have to find the lead author on that.
It's the brand new ones. I'll eventually find it. But
they're
looking at the plantar flexor. So mainly muscles that are undergoing concentric contractions. Is that right?
Yes.
So that's the thing that makes me wonder here to some degree. So if we imagine, what sort of cellular environment would be conducive to keeping a satellite cell in place? Or turning on those markers keeping a myonucleus in place that's derived from a satellite cell. and what kind of markers would need to be, you know, sort of flag that nucleus for do not dispose, like keep this one around. You can get muscle growth with concentric only training in humans as well, but it's not very damaging. We know that satellite cells are turned on by both muscle damage and then something that would cause hypertrophy, both.
Yes. So,
and, you know, it's, the question is always sort of like, to what degree is muscle damage? Do you need to be, how much muscle damage is too much? There's probably sort of a hormetic relationship between too much inflammation, too much damage, and, you know, how well a stimulus will produce an adaptation. But I wonder too, is if you might get a different answer to those questions you were just posing. If you're comparing a model where you're looking at concentric only contractions, where you don't have a whole lot of damage, and to maintain the muscle cell size or what have you, you're mainly just thinking about turning on protein synthesis. Because you don't have a whole lot of breakdown to manage, and maybe it's something about the satellite cells being turned on and doing their job as a new myonucleus. Their stability there is a function of the extent of damage and inflammation that comes into play, because that would give them more roles. So if someone's doing a lot of damaging, even eccentrically based contractions, that would be interesting. And like there's a model that Ted Wong and Frank Booth used years and years ago. I set this up in my lab way back when in Texas, where you can stimulate the tibial nerve and get rats to do plantar flexion, basically calf presses. And the plantar flexors overwhelm the anterior tib during each of those contractions. So, and they did this. It's an old study, but it's a pretty cool one. It's one of the studies where they first figured out, eccentric produce a lot of muscle growth with a lot of damage there. Eccentrics, generally speaking, and even the meta-analyses that have been done comparing concentric versus eccentric suggest a little bit of a favoritism for eccentric contractions as far as muscle growth. In this rat study, they looked at the anterior tib, and it grew like crazy. It grew much faster because it was just doing forced eccentrics. You turn on the stim, they would plantar flex the foot against the load, and it was just like basically a maximal eccentric contraction while the plantar flexors move the weight. And so that anterior tib grew like crazy, and the other muscles did as well. This was an animal model of resistance training. So maybe there's something different too, because we know that there's something special about eccentric contractions. You can look, not all the studies show this, but even Dudley did another study. This is for NASA. One of the things that they have trouble with in terms of maintaining muscle size and space is you've got no gravity. So, you know, you can't do
eccentric stuff.
There's no eccentric stuff. That's part of the reason. So they come up with the pretty cool flywheels where your own energy can be used to feed back in eccentric loading on the muscles. And there's actually in Germany, there's like a whole line of equipment. I've got someone on my discussion board who uses these things. They're pretty cool. These kind of flywheel based training. It's very common. I can send you a link to that stuff too, if you want. But so I wonder if there's something about it, just thinking out loud, like not that you intentionally want to create like, you know, ruin your day type of muscle soreness where you're doing dive bombing the toilet every time you try to sit down. You don't want to be that sore, but something about the muscle soreness and the damage may be important for like basically anchoring the myonuclei in place. And who knows?
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think
with that intensity, that might be why myonuclei are retained after synergistic ablation. It's so intrusive and it causes muscle damage that maybe these markers, and this would kind of make sense in terms of evolution, is because if the stimulus was so ridiculously intensive, you'd want the myonuclei that accumulated from that to be retained, because if they disappeared and you were sustained exposed to that stimulus, you'd want to be able to adapt to it quicker on a second occasion. So it might be intensity and, like you're saying, duration. So with these extremely intensive things, the permanency of a myonuclei might happen in a shorter time frame, and it might be protected from degradation. Whereas in these running on the treadmill kind of things, where it's not as damaged to muscle, potentially you need to do that for a longer period of time for the permanency to be acquired.
Right. I mean, literally, if you think about like really kind of a real life day in the life of a poor rat who severs part of his Achilles, Now he's limping around. Like, it is a life or death situation for him. If he can't get up back up to running speed, ASAP, he's going to get snagged by the cat, you know? Tom's going to come in and snag Jerry, or was Tom the cat? And Jerry? Yeah, I think it was that was. And so that is really definitely something that would, that, like as you said, would really bring about a really robust, potentially permanent adaptation or ability to adapt more readily as opposed to running on a treadmill. And I don't know what they did in Muroc's study and how they graded it in terms of intensity and variation, but you know, there is something to say for, and we know that if you're doing the same exercise, you add something that's novel, the soreness will go up. And using a variety of exercises seems to help in maximally developing muscles. So there's something about novelty of stimulus and changing the stimulus that you're not going to get if you just put the rats on a treadmill and allow them to do what they can already do. If you were to change it up, you know, I wonder if that would create a different effect too. So,
Our group is hoping to do an animal study. It's not. Also, I should just credit. It's the guy that did the study we're talking about in mice where the nuclei go down is by Corey Dungan. That's the lead author on there, and Kevin Murak is a second author. Our group is trying to do a study in mice. The other PhD student in my group, his name is Jaskard Lima, is working on organizing that. And his model is to not do treadmill running with progressive overload, but is said to do ladder climbing with progressive overload. And look at, attaching, it's actually attaching weight to their tail. Yeah, basically.
Yeah, and the same.
And the same thing is you will they will run a certain number of times up and down the ladder. So then you have reps and then you have sets where they do that a certain period of time in the training session. And through time, you add more weight to their tail. And that's how progressive overload. And maybe the same thing will happen. Maybe the nuclei might decrease in that instance because maybe the intensity is not enough, or maybe it will be, or we'll have to see. But maybe you're right. Maybe if you did a study where you used two different modes, if the nuclei were retained after that, then that would be quite interesting. If they weren't, just the single modes respectively, that would be quite interesting, wouldn't it?
And there's cool. this protective effect that comes into play. You probably know that, like, the most, as far as I know, Jose Antonio's study with the quail, where he progressively overloaded over the course of like 28 days, but he took days off. Yeah, he stretched it, and it was a progressive loading, but he would go for a certain number of days. I can't remember the exact protocol, but then he'd take a few days off. And I imagine when they reloaded, there was a reinitiation of some of the damage and inflammation. Kind of like, you know, you basically took away the stimulus, then you reapplied it. And in the context of what we're talking about, it maybe even makes me think, like, okay, so there's a stimulus, you got to adapt to it, and then it goes away, and then boom, here it comes again. If nature is as smart as we think it is, that would be like a repeated reminding, hey, you need to be able to adapt to this because it's going to come and it's going to go and it's going to come and it's going to go. Of course, that's what happens with resistance training. But that was, they produced like 280% increase in wet weight of the anterior lipismus dorsi. And that is just like crazy how much size they got out of that muscle. And that was in a month. And the interesting thing there is, like, that's one of the best examples of hyperplasia as well. The cells actually were getting smaller at the end of that study. The muscle mass was getting larger, but the cells were getting smaller. So that's, you know, that does fit with some of, like, the older stuff with bodybuilders, like Always stuff, where they find the bodybuilders, and Jose talks about this in his review articles, where bodybuilders have average size fibers but really, really big muscles. And it's like, okay, so how did this happen? Did they start off with really, really little fibers but a lot of them, and they just grew them all to normal size? Or did they start off with normally sized fibers and end up with more fibers because they've been weight training for decades?
That's maybe hyperplasia is how you become. Some people are gifted for that, and how they become absolute mass monsters, like Big Ramy or someone like that, is just somehow gifted to respond to hyperplasia with resistance training, and then you turn out like him. With the eating and the training and all the other stuff as well, obviously. But
would love to see Tom Platz's, a biopsy of Tom Platz's quad. You know, even now,
Even now,
what's going on? Yeah, he's still squatting. Yeah. He's still training. But if you think about like what would bring about hyperplasia to like what's actually going on there, like the cell splitting is one of the ideas, and like literally like that's connected in some way with damage. Like literally you're literally like kind of tearing apart the fibers. There's so much disruption in there that may be part of what's happening, and it has to sort of, you know, split itself. There's reasons probably for like diffusion reasons, diffusing of metabolites.
That'd be the main one.
But in order to bring that about, like that's a tremendous, treacherous, probably extremely painful for many, many years type of phenomenon, which fits with what high level bodybuilders and, you know, Olympic athletes have been doing. Those people brutalize themselves just in a way that you can't get people to do in a lab who are untrained. You know, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Anyway, so your study, like, let's talk a little bit more about what you're doing with folks and what the subjects, when they come in, what they go through and what they can kind of get information-wise.
Yes. So if anyone is interested, they should email me. We can reimburse their travel expenses from anywhere within the United Kingdom or Europe, as long as you are male, age 20 to 40 years old. And we are at the point in our research now where we have actually biopsied over 40 individuals. Nice. And we have sampled 10 current users and 6 past users, and the others are sedentary people and people who lift weights and don't take steroids. And the last weekend of October, 26, 27, 28 October 2019, which is next month, is the last biopsy session for 2019 for our research. We will be doing more sampling sessions in 2020. So even if you are listening to this and you can't make that date, we will be doing some more in 2020. So always just email me if you develop an interest in wanting to take part. I should have mentioned we maintain anonymity in this project, where I will be the only person that interviews somebody in regards to their anabolic steroid usage. I'm ethically obliged to not disclose that to anybody. And someone gets anonymized to a random participant number, which there is then no cross-reference between them or the number. And we don't disclose anyone who has visited the lab or anything along those lines, or who is in what group. When they come to the lab, after we sign the consent form, we will measure their muscle mass. We have a bod pod, a bioimpedance scale, skin fold calipers. That's everything we have on our campus to be able to do muscle mass and body fat. We collect blood as well, and we'll be storing that, and then we will conduct the muscle biopsy. I know some people are kind of concerned with muscle biopsies. I have had one for this research because it's my PhD. I had to take part. It's conducted under local anesthetic by medical professionals who do biopsies of other organs and muscle for a living, so they're very experienced. We're actually also using an ultrasound to guarantee that we are indeed in the upper trapezius muscle, and we are biopsying exactly the halfway point between the end of the shoulder and the last vertebrae of the neck, which is the descending to upper part of the trapezius muscle, which has been shown to have the higher androgen receptor content. And we do two types of biopsy needles, actually. We use a micro biopsy needle, and that extracts no more than 10 to 15 milligrams of tissue per firing. We do that 4 times. And the reason why we do that 4 times is we preserve them in genetic preservatives, so we can look at the DNA, RNA, protein, and have one sample spare. So we can keep all of those samples, and then we'll change the needle for a University College Hospital needle, which is slightly larger. Suction is then applied and a single muscle piece is then extracted. That is then placed in a preservative that I then put into liquid nitrogen to fully freeze. And that is what then will get looked at under the microscope. There's no more than a 5 millimeter mark made by a scalpel in which the needles are inserted. So you will not have more than a 5 millimeter mark that has to then close after the biopsy. And 48 hours later, that mark made by the scalpel would have closed and you would be healed from the biopsy. Most people that have had a biopsy on the weekend, come the Wednesday or Thursday, they're back to normal training and they don't feel anything. And the procedure itself, you'll only feel a very slight, you'll feel a pressure sensation, but it's along the lines of someone sort of poking you in the back with their thumb, no more than that. And actually the micro biopsy itself, in the research anyway, has got a pain scale the same as someone taking your blood. So that's not obviously very painful at all. The University College Hospital needle is, you feel it a bit more because of the pressure of the needle. But that's required to extract a muscle piece to be frozen. So that's everything that the participants have received, and then they're off on their way. And then we then invite people to come back if they do cycle off anabolic steroids roughly 20 weeks later, so we can then see, has their muscle mass declined or is it maintained? And then importantly, has their nuclei numbers been maintained or have they gone down? And also look at the pathways of growth and how they have changed through time.
So will you be able to, from the larger biopsy, give them a fiber type percentage?
Yeah, for sure. So the larger muscle biopsy, we will be counting the nuclei, the number of stem cells, fiber area, fiber type, and we're going to try and do blood capillary supply as well.
So there's not, I haven't seen a whole lot of data on the trapezius. I have seen, I think, a study with power lifters, and just as a thought, now I'm thinking kind of an experimenter. One of this study, at least the criticism is either voiced in the paper or one that I thought of, is that they found a lot of evidence of damage when they biopsied the trap and the power centrally located nuclei, things like that. But it also occurred to me, well, these guys are loading a bar with 500,000 pounds on their traps. So there may have been some traumatic kind of crush injury there. Are you going to try to control for that in some way and keep people like, hey, don't do any heavy squatting or at least try to avoid the areas in the trap where they would getting potentially like literally crush injury type of.
That's a good point. I discussed with them what their training program is like, and if they are doing barbell squats or if they're doing safety squat bars or leg presses, hack squats, and things along those lines.
Right.
So that way we can sort of control for it that way. But this study is obviously, it's an observational study. We are inviting people to our lab they've designed their own steroid cycle that they're taking. They designed their own training programs. They've designed their own nutrition, and we are monitoring them through time. Same way, if someone is taking anabolic steroids, they're not planning on coming off and they just come for a one-time visit. We're just observing what's their muscle like, how big is it, what's the pathways of growth like. I think if in this study we can see some inclination that there is a memory of steroid exposure, then I'd hope we might be able to do a more well-controlled study where fingers crossed, it would be amazing if we could maybe even do a low dose administration testosterone study and see through time these things and control their training, their eating, and everything a bit more. Because if we do show this, then there's going to be, well, the next conclusion is let's do more research that's a bit more well-controlled. So I'd really, that'd be an amazing outcome. I would have to see what happens. I mean, our group is also involved in organizing a study where we're going to be monitoring men as they transition to women and women as they transition to men and follow them. And the ethics for that study has just been approved about a month ago, and we will be recruiting people who are on the wait list to have hormonal therapy and transition gender in either direction. And once they do start, just before they start the hormonal therapy, and then in a sort of 6, 12, 18 months after that period, we'll invite them back to the lab for regular testing to see aerobic capacity, strength, do some muscle biopsies and do things along those lines, so we can sort of see, does the muscle remember that it was in a high testosterone environment for many years after they transitioned to becoming a female? So that's, and in the same way, because the women are going to be given sustenon most likely to become male, then that's kind of like an administration study in one way. So you might be able to see nuclei accumulation there, but there's not necessarily detraining going on. So still, the more information, the better. But I would really like from this to be able to maybe write an application or to be able to do an administration study.
Yeah. So you shared a study with me it was a case study of a woman who had administered like 50 milligrams of nandrolone, I think it was, per week for 6 weeks. And 20 That's years exactly later, it. She still had changes in her voice. And actually, they sort of progressed along the time. Since she'd used the gear. And So that I just thought you're the man here to like sort of maybe substantiate this idea that I've had. I think I've expressed here with Scott chatting before, but if you think about the fact that, you know, during the course of puberty, but before puberty, body composition, many things about boys and girls is the same visually. You can differentiate them, but the exposure to androgens creates a substantial change in all the secondary sexual characteristics, aspects of the brain, so many things that persist. And even if someone will become hypogonadal, a male becomes hypogonadal for whatever reason, an accident or course of time, chemical exposure, whatever it may be, he doesn't then revert back to looking like a female. Those characteristics stay in place in large part. I mean, he might lose some hair. My dad had prostate cancer, and they castrated him chemically in order to try to slow the progression thereof. And he lost hair, and he actually had some gynecomastia at the end. But it wasn't like all of a sudden he started looking like a female version of my dad. He looked like my dad the entire time. So I've always sort of likened, and this is just for the women out there who are listening, who are thinking about gear use and how to cycle that on and off and how to consider that. From a scientific perspective, it seems like, at least in the context of epigenetics and what's going on with development of secondary, it very much can be considered, or could be considered in some cases, depending on the person, somewhat of a one-way street, in that if you experience some androgenicity, androgen change, like hirsutism is one, hair growth, facial hair growth, seems like that can, those genes can get turned on epigenetically and then stay on, even if there's no gear use thereafter. Yeah. Is that kind of your understanding, is that some of those things are like you're inching forward and you can come back as a woman coming off, but you still are risking never being able to go back once you've turned on some of those genes to where you once started? It's basically they're on, and some of them just stay on. The switches are on,
yeah,
and they'll be on for decades potentially. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And that would, so the epigenetic, the regions of the DNA that are then responsible for hair growth, and then some reason they're maintained in being open, and that's it. And you're not going to be able to change that. And so you then will then, as you say, experience hair growth for the rest of their life. What I was really surprised about was only after 6 weeks, this lady had taken nandrolone 50 milligrams a week for only 6 weeks. And then for 20 years, her voice was then permanently lower. And she'd actually tried to have surgery to try and increase the pitch in her voice to stop having a low husky voice. And that was not successful. And she felt like it impacted her ability to get certain jobs. In her opinion, at interview, having a low husky voice and things along those lines. And that, I think that's why she was happy to be a research participant to discuss and the fact her larynx had changed and her voice box had caused this lower pitch voice. And that's the same thing, the end organ growth as then not decreasing afterwards. So the same thing, the markers that have caused organ growth have not, they are maintained open, or at least they're not causing any atrophy afterwards. So, right. Yeah,
and
there's a memory
also
there.
Also left with low testosterone, I believe, if I remember reading that correctly. So for a woman, she was lacking testosterone too. So she'd shut down her own normal testosterone levels. So her libido was lost as well. So she got the negative side effects in both directions, the permanent ones. And then, you know, she didn't maintain the normal elevation sex drive that she was, or the extraordinary elevation sex drive she was getting from the gear. So, yeah, it's just one of those things that I bring it up, not to kind of like put a damper on the conversation, but it fits with what we're talking about. And it's something that is not put forth very often, that because coaches maybe don't even know this. And, you know, athletes, especially in the physique realm, become really focused on, you know, being in the zone, grinding, doing whatever it takes. You know, that's sort of a mentality that we have. And it's worthwhile knowing that this is literally, there's a payoff, you know, that if you deal with the devil, like, he's going to have his due. And with women, I think it's a substantially different one than with men, in a way that many of them, you know, probably wouldn't do if they had full understanding like you do, for instance, or at least my concept of things. They, many women probably would think twice before doing what they what they've done. I imagine this woman in the case study most absolutely. 6 weeks, 20 years ago, still haunting her. That's awful.
I know.
That just sucks.
That's crazy, isn't it? It's such a short... And 6 weeks for a man of steroid usage is unlikely to haunt them 20 years later.
Yeah.
You know, that's really not really going to happen. So it goes to show, doesn't it, the disparity in the permanency of the side effect. And that in itself is a form of memory as well, really.
Scott, any questions? You're silently listening to the scientific mumbo jumbo geeking out over here.
Nope, I'm just sitting back and enjoying. I didn't have too much to add, so I just kept my mouth closed. I've just enjoyed listening to you guys talk,
cool.
and I'm looking forward to seeing how things turn out. I believe it sounds, Alex, like you have a lot more participants than you did when we last spoke. I think it sounds like the numbers have increased, so I'm glad to hear that you're getting a good cross-section of people. And that things are growing and that things are going successfully, man. It's I can't wait. You know, last time we had you on, there were so many people that said, man, you got to keep us posted about what happens, you know, what the results are. So you have a lot of people sitting on the edge of their seats waiting.
No, thank you. I mean, and the increase in participant numbers has come from, you know, I'm very appreciative of you being able to do this podcast, the one with Dave and the drugs and stuff. I've been on the Iron Culture podcast recently, episode 29, Sigma Nutrition Radio. I've done some videos with Omar Esoff as well on his YouTube channel discussing this. And I'm very grateful for all those opportunities because that's how I've ended up recruiting a lot of people. So thank you very, very, very much for having me. And if anyone is interested, just send me an email. I'll be able to take the conversation further with you. If you are a current or past user of anabolic steroids, age 20 to 40, living in Europe or the United Kingdom, particularly, it'd be great to get you involved on the 26th, 27th or 28th of October, 2019. If not, then we might be able to get you involved in 2020. So just send me an email. We can take the conversation further. The more people we have, the better for statistical purposes for us to really be able to identify this change. And in general, there hasn't really been any research published for, well, at least 5 years on super physiological dosages of androgens in humans from muscle biopsies. And so this is going to add to our body of knowledge. And so the more people, the better. So thank you very much, Scott, for this opportunity.
Oh, man, absolutely.
And to Dr. Scott for having a nerd out, because I always like to do
this. Yeah, I enjoyed it. That was awesome, man. And I tell you what, I think, Scott, I think you titled this Gear Equals Superhuman? On Facebook, maybe. And
yes.
Let me toss this out. This is a chance for anyone who likes to nerd out. Yeah. Those subjects will spend a long amount of time with you, so they could probably ask you many questions. I'm sure you get a lot of sort of off-topic questions about all sorts of stuff that you really can't answer. But one of the things that many people are doing, like there's various companies that are doing sort of a DNA analysis to see, they try to prescribe what sort of training you should do and what have you. I would imagine that if someone were to actually do multiple biopsies, maybe when they're on and off, to see what extent the genes get turned back on, or you're going to be able to couch their results in the context of everyone you found there and see where they lie along the spectrum. Maybe, you know, some people have 80 proteins that persist in higher amounts, like the other study had demonstrated, and other people only have 5. So some people, basically everything gets turned off once they're off and they tend to lose their gains. This literally, in a certain way, I think someone, if they went in and stayed in contact and paid attention to their data, and I don't want to speak for you, Alex, to say that you can give them information that you can't, but it's their own data. But you could really probably give them some really interesting, at least if not useful, information. It's like, look, when you come off, you're off, and you don't hold on to any of the molecular signature of having been on previously compared to the other people we looked at. Chances are you're going to have to do everything you can to hang on to all your gains, just so you know, if you want to continue to do
that. Yeah.
Else might know that, you know, they're on the other spectrum. So this is more valuable information than I think a lot of those genetic analyses are giving, because you're going into like literally what is happening in the cells, not what the genes suggest might be the case based
That's
on some data
true.
That really isn't applicable. So this is a chance to get some really good information. Are they getting compensated for their their participation, or is it just free volunteers?
We reimburse all their travel, provide food, pay for their food on their journey. We don't pay them for when they come, but it's at no expense to them. The only thing we need is their time and their willingness to be able to take part. And like you said, I mean, you got to pay quite a bit of money to get a bod pod reading as well. So if you just want to know your muscle mass, this is great because you'll get that for free. And if you then come off anabolics, you then truly see how much muscle do I actually retain when I come off anabolics? How much did I manage to hold on to? How much muscle have I grown? If you're on a blast, you might just be interested in coming along and seeing what is your total body water content like? What is your muscle mass like? What's your body fat percentage like? You'll come and give us a muscle biopsy that will enhance our knowledge on the pathways of growth. If you went and came off, you do your PCT, you come back 6 months later, you might see the same thing. What's your muscle mass, your body water content, your body fat like? And if you trained really hard still after coming off, you ate appropriately, you ticked all the boxes, you then will get a comprehensive look for you as an individual. How much muscle do you retain cycling on and off anabolic steroids?
I would imagine, and you tell me how off I am, but if you were to try to create a commercial price for what people are getting, like literally the cost for the personnel do the bod pod and the blood work, and the storage of things and all the analyses that you're doing, it's hundreds of quid what people are getting for nothing. Plus they get food, you're getting fed, you get to take a cool trip, you get to geek out, and you get all sorts of badass bodybuilding information that you're not going to get anywhere. Like you could say, I was part of this landmark study. I'm going to be in the UK like in November, maybe I can get me in there, you know? Anyway, this is a good opportunity, people. It would be phenomenally fun, I think, to do this. And this is the kind of thing that if you're thinking about grad school, too, you're not quite sure, you'll get some insight as to how the shit really goes down. So this is an awesome opportunity. I hope you guys, if you're in Europe and you can make it for those dates, contact Alex and come out for it.
And guys, and like you said, they're going to learn a lot. And the more people we have, the better for this research. I don't know if another study like this is going to be conducted for some time. So I think we try and make the most of the opportunity that we have to get as many people involved as possible.
So check the show notes, guys, down at the bottom. You can find Alex's email there. Of course, if you're listening to this at the YouTube page, if you're listening to this on iTunes, we'll also have it in the show notes there, as well as on advicesradio.com. Alex, much appreciate your time, man. And Scott, I appreciate the sciences that we're all flowing around through the air this morning between you guys. This is a lot of fun to listen to.
Yeah, it was fun.
All right,
thanks,
guys.
Alex. Appreciate
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. This program has been brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. You can use our code, which is Advices. We also have our second code, which is Advices Oats for 25% off of their oatmeal blends. For another episode of Advices Radio and the Think Big Bodybuilding Media channel over at YouTube. Guys, we will see you soon. Thanks, Alex. Thanks, Scott.